Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
So designing for scalability. So really we're going to focus on kind of three key things. How do I add capacity in a distributed system? If I have one database, how can I have five? If I have three storage accounts, how can I have seven? And conversely, how can I take them away from a running system? Because elasticity works in both directions. I can stretch out, but I also want to come back together for cost optimization sometimes. I want to be able to optimize. This is the classic area we talk about in software engineering as picking, you know, better algorithms, better data structures, making things run faster. Note that if we were teaching a kind of a traditional software design approach, this would be all of the scalability. Here it's just one piece. And the last one is around shifting. And this is kind of a little thing I've phrased of, how can we take work and move it from an expensive system to a cheaper system? How can I do work in table storage instead of SQL? How can I do work in memory instead of an external system? And this one actually tends to have pretty profound implications around scalability. And we'll also look at how the scale limits of each of the Azure Core platform services comes into play and how we work with them and work around them rather than trying to work against them. So key thing is we get scalability in a cloud service not by throwing hardware but by careful design. We design and implement our systems such that the platform will give us scalability and then we can dial it up and dial it down. Ultimately, we have to partition our application, state and logic. We have to optimize communication because my distributed system is only as good as the threads that tie it together. And we need to look at cheaper ways of getting the same thing done. So this is how we'll spend the next hour together, or 55 minutes. So setting the stage. Some of the techniques and approaches I'm going to talk about may very well be overkill for a lot of the stuff that you do. This is where we keep coming back to, it's a trade-off. In a lot of places, we're introducing additional complexity, introducing additional dev time, introducing additional moving parts in exchange for the ability to scale very large. I'll try and call out some of the general areas at which some of these things start to kick in, or if they're pervasive in nature. So I think about millions of users, hundreds of thousands of operations concurrent per second, thousands of cores, hundreds of databases, dozens of storage accounts. Okay, so let's talk about the path to scale in a little more detail. The most important one is partitioning. If you do not partition your app, you can never have more than one scale unit, whether that's the maximum size of one database, one storage account, one whatever. This is the most important thing in scaling a distributed system. Optimization is improving density. It's reducing cost. But if we can't compose more scale units, optimizing doesn't get us anything. We'll still be bouncing off one scale unit. And shifting is really about how do we start playing with consistency? How do we play with durability? How do we play with queryability in order to get more work out of a given set of resources? Really, we want to optimize. So when I think about the scalability, I think about maximizing throughput with bounded latency. How can I get more operations, more users, more work through a system, maintaining latency within SLA boundaries? So we'll go a lot into each of these. Okay, fundamentally, and I cannot reinforce this point enough, I know I'm flogging an expired equine, but this is all about scale out. The only reason I keep coming back to it, and I know you all get this, I know you've all had it reinforced, and I'm going to keep doing it, is because our customers do not get this. They are so used to, yeah, my application is scale out. Okay, well, your app and your web tiers are. Where's your state? Oh, I have one giant honking SQL database. Isn't that what you mean by scale out? No. Everything from the time your user shows up at your service endpoint all the way through to your logging infrastructure and your management infrastructure must scale out. So we already went through these. We'll just do a recap. I cannot have a larger than an 8-core machine. So if the work I need to do requires more than 8 cores, I have to be able to partition the work, assign it to multiple instances, and work with the results. Most web-facing applications are fairly isolated in that a request comes in, flows through the system, and back out again. There are other types of workloads that do not work this way. HPC-style, large, heavy compute workloads don't work from a single request in to a single request out. I actually need to schedule and allocate work, and I need ways to do that. Storage. I'm going to hit limits. They're pretty big limits. They've gotten a lot bigger. But so if you have customers that will never get beyond this limit, you may not need to employ multiple storage accounts. But if you bake it in from the beginning, then adding more storage accounts is a configuration experience, not a we need 3 weeks to rewrite and retest. It is generally a lot cheaper to bake this stuff in at the beginning. And relational databases are notoriously difficult to scale out. So we're going to go through a little exercise. We're going to walk you through, with code, if you want to see it, all of the decisions, the implementation approaches required to implement a database schema that can scale out to 30 million users and 500 databases. Because these are fun numbers. But the thing is, 2 or 500 in terms of the pure database schema and the management, they're actually the same number. There is no real difference. Three numbers in computing, 0, 1, and more. So we're going to talk about more. And the nice thing about the elastic nature of cloud is more is whatever you want it to be. Okay, so let's talk about a couple of partitioning schemes, then we'll dive into what that really means in terms of your application. So let's look at a pretty canonical, this would be very natural to see on-premise, where I have a bunch of user information. I've got some metadata, and I've got some binary data. When the cost of managing the state platform is very high, such as a SAN-backed, highly available, mirrored, log-shipped, add your acronym of choice, SQL Server or Oracle Server, you put your database of choice in there. Having multiple state stores does not make sense. The cost of manageability is so high, and the tool is so general purpose that I consolidate everything within. That's why we have file stream. That's why we can put binary data in relational stores. In the cloud, in Azure, when they're both services controlled by API calls where operational manageability is someone else's problem, this equation changes. It doesn't make sense to jam binary data into the relational store. I'm going to use the binary store. So what do? We'll get to that in a second. But first of all, I want to be able to split this metadata up. So I want to tease these apart. So let's take a simple horizontal partitioning approach. I'm going to basically use the first letter of the last name and create a database or even a table or a schema as a container and put everyone in there. So who sees the giant problem with this partitioning function?
How many M's are you going to have opposed to how many Z's?
Excellent. How many M's versus how many Z's? Distribution. This is never a uniform distribution. In fact, I think it's probably like 1,000 to 1 between the number of people with a Z as a last name or M. Just using kind of Western European derived names, I'm sure that it's variable depending on kind of where the name set's coming from. But this is a highly non-uniform mix. So this is one of the other things. When we're thinking about partitioning, how uniform is the partitioning function? How evenly does it spread load? And does that change over time? Some kind of input data sets are very fluid. The partitioning scheme you start with will probably not be the one that you have in 3 months. And it's very, very expensive to rebalance sometimes because you have to move data. All right, so that's horizontal. Let's talk about vertical. Vertical is going, okay, let's take the types of data and put them in different places. In an on-premises relational database, it would probably be I take my binary data and put it in a file stream table, and I put my metadata in a normal table. In the cloud, this is going to be, okay, I want to put my rich, queryable, secondary indexed metadata into a relational store so I can get at it from any direction. I can ask queries based on any column. I'll put my key value lookup table, which is really what thumbnail data is. I'll put it in tables so I get quick access. I can put it in blobs as well, but I might want to attach some metadata with my thumbnails. And I'll put my photos, my large objects, in my binary large object store. Seems to stand to reason. Now, what am I trading off? Consistency. I cannot do a globally atomic update between my metadata and my photo. It's not going to happen. That's the price I pay for throughput. Most commonly, what you're actually going to see is a hybrid, where I'm going to both horizontally partition my metadata for scalability, and I'm going to vertically partition my data schema for adaptability to a specific store. This is why we spent a lot of time talking about what are your options for data. Let's break this one down. This is queryable metadata. I'm going to come at this from any direction. Every individual piece of data has value, and I don't know how I'm going to need to query it. I may come in through last name, I may come in through first name, I may come in through email. If I do this in table storage, I must manually create multiple index tables and maintain them by hand. That may be attractive if I have 250 million users to deal with. It may not. I instead may go, I will just do some range-based partitioning, keep this data in relational, and maintain pointers to table and blobs, because everything in table or blob is a URL. So I can maintain a piece or the entire URL in SQL and access it relatively cheaply. And then I can put my non-relational, my key value lookup data, because if I go for my thumbnail, I'm always going to have a deterministic piece of data. I'm going to have the user ID. So what do I need? I need a configuration value that tells me the storage account, the base, and the table name, and the user ID. And I can grab the thumbnail and I can grab the photo from tables or blobs. So my hybrid approach here works very well. So when I'm coming to design one of these, what questions do I have to ask? Regardless of what you're doing, you will always go through the same four steps. I'll bring this one full circle back to federations in a second. The very first thing I will do is I will select a partitioning key, something that I will hook off of to get to a partitioning value. It can be a name, it can be an ID, it can be a composite of things. But it's going to be something that will uniquely identify, or at least partially uniquely identify the data in question. So the second thing is I'm going to convert the partition key to a partition value through some function. This can be a deterministic function, this can be a lookup function that contains partial state, this can be any number of things. But I'm going to switch from the last name, or I'm going to switch from the raw value to something that can be used as an index into the actual partition map. So for example, in the previous one, I might go from the last name and then use a function to map that to the first letter or the first couple of letters. I will then map my partition value into a logical partition in the system. So for example, I may go to a map of shards or a map of partitions, look and basically get the database that corresponds to SI, in case you hadn't noticed, I'm using myself as this particular example. Now, the interesting part here is depending on the system, depending on what you're working with, the system may do one or more of these steps for you. If I'm working with SQL, I need to do all of these. If I'm working with table storage, once I get to step two, I'm done. I give table storage the partition key. It does the work of mapping that to a logical partition and then mapping that to a physical resource under the hood. If I'm working with SQL that doesn't have these built-in partition capabilities, I then need to go from the partition value to a logical partition, and then the logical partition description to a connection string, to a specific database, to a specific table on a specific server. No matter what you work with, you're always going to go through these steps. This applies to a load balancer. Let's look at how a load balancer goes through this particular exercise. Let's do a non-affinitizing load balancer, and let's do a sticky load balancer. Non-affinitizing, the partition key is there is none. It's just I have a socket. The partition function is take the socket, pass it through. The partition value to logical partition is which node am I going to hit? Random, 1 to 30, or however many I have. And the logical to physical map is node 27 to the IP address. Every single partitioning exercise goes through these steps. Some may be pass-throughs, some may be null functions, but everything goes through this. So let's look at a range-based database. I'll cover what the partitioning function categories are in a second. So let's start with, that username seems familiar. It's mine, in case you weren't. I figured you guys got that. So the user ID is a natural partitioning mechanism in a user-centric application, in a user-centric site, assuming that usernames have global uniqueness. If they don't, I can get collisions here. So I will use a non-cryptographic hash to convert my name into a value. Why would I use a non-cryptographic hash? I want to be fast, that's one item. So by their very nature, cryptographic hashes are slow. One, because they're more mathematically intense, and two, a slower hash is actually more secure for cryptography. There's actually another reason. Not small is a good one, but it's not quite what we're going for, because I can always take the output value and start chopping it up.
They are always unique. They are always unique.
Yes, a one of the values of a cryptographic hash is that its result does not collide, that it is unique. I want to collide. I want to bucket. I want to come down from a very large source set to a relatively uniform output set. I want to reduce the space. I want to go from an infinite range of possibilities down to 32,000 possibilities. So I want a colliding hash, which drives the security people completely insane. This is not for security. This is a bucketing exercise or a ranging exercise. I want to take a large set of values and bring them down into a small range of values quickly, efficiently, and deterministically. So absolutely, speed and collisions, or bucketization. So from here, I want to map a range of integers to a logical shard. This is using the same partitioning mechanism that federations use. It's range-based. I take a range of values, minus max value to plus max value, and I slice it up. That doesn't have to be even, because I can have different weighting in the system. Hotspots can evolve over time. And I'm just going to say, hey, look at my shard map, which is either a static or a dynamic lookup. Give me the shard value associated with this input value. And then given that shard, tell me how to connect to it. In a second, I'll go through and actually show you this code. So we built out a fairly large-scale social media site sometime last year. And this is the mechanism we used, and we're pretty close. We're just going through the last little bit of legal stuff to release all of the code required to build a very large scale out kind of social and data management experience on SQL Azure and say, here's the code, do what you want with it. Again, it's just how do you work with the platform? How do you take advantage of kind of where its bounding boxes are and work around them? But no matter what you do, so I talked about range partitioning. You really have about three options. I can do a range based. I take my partition key range and I slice it up. Evenly or not evenly, which means that I need some form of lookup function to figure out the range map. I can do buckets. Buckets are actually more common, they're actually more useful, which is I take the range, I split it up into an even number of individual buckets, and then I map those buckets against physical resources. Or I have a lookup assignment. This is actually the most generic. This is the most flexible. So when we think about partitioning, we also need to think about repartitioning or rebalancing. In the range-based world, if I need to rebalance, if I have a hotspot, if I have a, God knows why I'm actually going to say this, but if I have a Justin Bieber who is wildly popular on my site, or some other, you know, media star, and Twitter has this challenge with all of their big folks, one user can overwhelm that partition that they're in. So I would need to shrink down that partition, move away the cold users from the hot users. In a range-based partition, I just want to think of splitting and merging contiguous ranges. That's the rebalancing exercise. In a bucketing exercise, I pick the bucket up and put it on a different physical instance. In a lookup-based model, I can move a single user by changing their lookup. But the trade-off is the amount of state involved in managing each of these maps. In a range-based, basically, I need something that can take a value and return, you know, basically do contiguous lookups. In a bucket-based, it's a mod function. It's very cheap. Lookup-based is I may need to maintain a globally mostly consistent hash table for everybody in my system. If I have 30 million users, this is challenging. It's doable, and I can show you how to do it, but it is challenging. So in general, I usually start with the logical buckets as my go-to standard. And I look at lookup-based partitioning if I need to have very fine-grained control over locality and affinity. But these are just plugging in two functions in that range of four. They're not fundamentally changing my system. They don't change my front-end application architecture, because I just go to some abstraction and say, hey, here's my key, where do I go? Or here's my key, run this query. Sure. If you guys want to see, I'll probably go through a little bit more content and then circle back, but I can show you all the functional code required to implement lookup properly. And the funny thing is, you implement the lookup table using logical partitioning. Because if I have a lookup table that big, I've got to partition the lookup table. So again, most of these approaches are compositional. You layer them together. None of them stand alone. So let's look at a range-based partition. Again, these are all very database-centric, mostly because it's harder, and you have to implement all of these yourselves. If you go to something that provides the logical to physical mapping, you just stop after step three and tell the system to deal with it. This is one of the reasons that, for go figure, systems that implement native partitionality are easier to partition and scale. That would be my third most obvious statement for today. I may make more obvious statements. So, in this world, we take John Smith. We use, there's many non-cryptographic hashing functions out there. Who's heard of Murmur hash? A couple hands. Murmur hash is cryptographically insecure. You should never use it as a hash table partitioning function because it is susceptible to collisions under heavy load and is known to be an attack vector. However, using it just to take data and split it up is perfectly fine. If someone ends up trying to craft this so they end up in a hot bucket, is really no worse than someone doing it by accident. So in this case, we basically take the upper value of John Smith because we don't want to care how people type it in. We hash it, we get out a value. That's the actual value from a Murmur 3 hash. We apply it to our shard map. In this case, we created 5 shards evenly spread across the integer 32 range. It comes out with shard 1. We look in a resource map. Shard 1 maps to user database 001. Again, there's a few steps here. Each individual step takes a little bit more work, but because I can do more of them in parallel, I get more throughput. There's a latency hit, absolutely, but we're optimizing for throughput. Logical bucket, same set of steps, different functions. I go through, I hash my value down to something reasonable, I put it through a shard map, which is, I take my value and I mod and take the absolute value. Some basic math. Shard 27, go through my resource map. Here's the difference. And this is when we talk about the isolation container. Depending on how you design your system, you either know what the logical to physical map is or you choose the logical to physical map. In the range-based partitioning, I was saying that the database itself was an isolation container. Is that for every shard, for every partition, I have a distinct database. I would never do this on premise. This would be insane, because a database is a pretty heavyweight item. In a database as a service world, the more databases I have, the more resources and the more throughput. I also actually have more failure points. We'll talk about that in the next one. This dynamic tension between how much capacity and how many different ways can I fail. And then that just gets mapped down into a database. Now, I have a couple different ways to do this. I can do this mapping based on tables, based on schema, or based on databases. Tables has the advantage of better density, but I have to manage table name translation directly in my data access layer. If I do it with databases, it just works. But if I do it with schemas, I'm kind of in this weird middle ground. And unfortunately, I can't talk about what the scalability limits of doing schema-based containers are. So for now, you're either table-based and you pay the hit and you're translating your data access layer, or you do it with databases. And in general, most folks are going to, do it with databases. All right, and then the lookup bucket. So essentially the way this really works is when you see that shard map for the lookup, it is itself a partition structure with caching and lookup. I go through, I take the value, I look up against my in-memory hash table, and even if I have 30 million items, okay, here's 50 megs of RAM, have a nice day, or 100 megs of RAM. Memory's cheap, especially when I'm scaling out. Most web workloads are not memory intensive. I'm okay with just trading time for space. Cache the ever-living bleep out of it. And in .NET 4 and above, large memory structures became more efficient. I would not do this in .NET 2. I would actually have multiple hash tables. .NET 4, we don't have to worry about this stuff anymore as much. So again, the lookup maps each individual partition to a specific resource. So I can control the clustering and I can change value by value by value. If I want to go in and edit a user, the rebalancing exercise goes from I need to lock out a million users and change them. If you have users that follow day and night cycles, this becomes pretty easy. This is one of those little tricks. How do I give 100% availability while taking parts of my system down? Okay. If I'm a gaming site and I know and I cluster my users by geography, I can do my my rebalancing and my maintenance activities at 4 o'clock in the morning. And one of them comes on, well, okay, well, I might give one user a bad experience. Is that okay in my SLA? I don't know. That's a business decision that leads to a set of engineering decisions. But I can start to play these games. Because the more of these partitions I have, I can take pieces of my system offline. Not physical ones, but logical workflows. I can take sets of my users offline and do interesting things with them. All right. Doing a quick time check. You guys want to see some code? All right. Lots of guys going, you're talking a big game. Let's see it. Let's actually see it. All right. If you give me a second to get back into my desktop, because my laptop hates me today. All right. So let's go to Contoso Social. As I said, this won't be released very soon. We're just going through all of the legal fun. Do 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 do. I'm really glad that Visual Studio 2012 has implemented asynchronous loading. Otherwise, we'd all be sitting here for 5 minutes, kind of staring at each other, going, "When does something fun happen?" All right. So this is as near to production quality code as I will ever put out on the internet, because it doesn't have all the ugly stuff that real production quality code actually has in it. Well, not too much of it. So let's actually go through and have a look at a data access layer that handles working against a sharded. My apologies, I will make this a little bigger now. Okay. So what I have here is a set of code that implements lookup-based partitioning. The root shard ID is the lookup map. This is basically where is your primary data. From the root shard, I then go to the actual consumer shard, which is the real data is. So anytime you see root, that's lookup. Anytime you see consumer or whatever else we actually called it, that's where the real data lives. One is lookup-based, the other one is actually range-based. So we have this two-tier partitioning scheme. So let's just look at what happens when I were to go and execute some actual code. I'm going to pull this back up one other layer because I actually want to go with some real. Okay, let's look at some user data management. And let's look at an example of how I would register a user in a system. There's a small bug in this code. I'll go through and type it out. So this starts with all kind of normal stuff, where I just go through and make sure no one's passing me garbage. I check the password. And I'm going to generate a GUID. Based on that GUID, I'm going to crank a shared ID. Well, how would I do that? Well, look at that. All I'm doing is a simple murmur hash over the GUID. Okay, nothing special there. That was my step two. I start with my GUID, and then I crank it down to a hashed value. So then I want to go through and I want to create the user in my root databases. I have two different ways of getting into my lookup value. I can come in with a user ID, or I can come in with an email. I could put both of these in the same table, then I create a hotspot. So instead what I do is I say, listen, I'm going to have a scale-out lookup tier, and it's going to have duplicated data. And I'm okay with that. You go in through one way, you'll end up on the shard that has the user IDs. You come in through one way, you'll map to the shard that has the user ID or the email. The specific details of the partitioning mechanism, not as important, is a couple of the tricks we're going to play along the way. I've extracted everything, so I basically say, hey, I want to do a root shard execute against this username. So if I'm a developer, I don't actually have to care. I've got an abstraction function that handles this for me. So I'm just going to go through and I'm going to execute this command. What root shard execute does is it goes through, given the key, it's going to calculate the shard key for root username, which is where I employ my bucketing mechanism. What's a bucket? Value, mod, number of shards, done. That's it. In fact, if we were to go and look at murmurhash.bucket, I have a configuration value that says how many root databases I have. I go and I bucket it up. And, oh, look, what does bucket do? Takes the hash value, mods by the number of buckets, and runs an absolute value over it so I don't end up with bucket minus 7. That's it. Again, getting all the little details right is important, but we've got some good good boilerplate coming. So given the shard ID, I want to go and I want to execute that. So a couple simple things. We'll talk about this in manageability. You absolutely must log every single access to an external service. You must do that. Most folks are going, that's an insane amount of logging. How could I ever sustain that in production? We'll talk about that later. I want to go and do my logical to physical shard map. A shard ID is a logical partition identifier. So I want to go to my map, which basically, let me zoom that out. This is a configuration file that has a list of all the shards. It's fairly static. We don't change it during online. We didn't design for that. But I'll basically go through and say, hey, which one of these shards is in range for this key? All right, and we go and we execute stuff against that shard. So this is an implementation of the, and this is actually a range-based partitioning implementation. But the magic is the values that I get back from that, that bucket-based partitioning is actually the lookup value that tells me where to go for the raw user data. So my lookup database is implemented as a range-based partition. It gives me the pointer to then go down to my my actual user data. Big latency hits, bouncing all back and forth, which is why we then layer caching on top of this so that you pay a penalty on the first hit, but after that you're running along pretty well. Question?
What about when you add more buckets? I would assume you don't want to just add them in and have them start populating. You need to redistribute.
So the question is, what happens during a rebalancing activity? So when I'm rebalancing, so what we did is we over-provisioned the lookup table. Said it has very little data and you only hit it once and then you cache it anyway. So we said, all right, we're going to have, I think we went with 16 databases for lookups, all like a gig each. So I will never rebalance those. That was basically provisioned for 250,000 users. We grossly over-provisioned by rolling out 16 1-gigabyte tables that cost $40 a month cumulative. Okay, that seems like a pretty safe bet. Then to roll out new partitions for the lookup is you add a new partition to the partition map. We did it with a configuration update as opposed to something dynamic, just an implementation choice. And then when you go to place new users, you just change the logic to favor that partition, or you go in behind the scenes, lock a user, and move them to the new shard, because you're only moving one user at a time. You can move 50 users at a time if you want, as 50 concurrent activities or as a batch, but the lookup table gives the ability to move one by one rather than having to rebalance entire shards. And that's why we generally favor that lookup-based mechanism for the really, really large sites that tend to be fairly dynamic.
Any breaking point versus the other?
So the question is around what's the breaking point? It really has to do with, you just kind of look at how often do I have to rebalance and what's the amount of data that I would have to rebalance in one shot. It's actually less to do with the rebalancing as it is to do with the uniformity. If I have a graph that can be very unbalanced, or sorry, a usage graph, if I have long tail, if I have users, individual entities in the system, they could be users, it could be workflows, that occupy disproportionate amounts of work. If I have one user that takes up a million times the resources of other users, I will always go with a lookup mechanism from the beginning. If every user will have nearly uniform load, I can probably just bucket and over-provision. So it has to do with the nature of the work that you're going with. The problem is, you have to get this right the first time, otherwise it's very expensive to change. But it's also relatively cheap to over-provision. Because you only get charged, the SQL databases are only charged by usage. So if you have 100 1-gig databases, you don't get charged very much. So it's stuff you would never think of doing in the box product. It's okay to do when the data stores are services. So let me rephrase the question for the benefit of the recording. This scheme involves at least two lookups before you can get any piece of data. This seems like very cacheable information. Would that be a fair statement? So yes, if the user space is small enough, you can cache all this stuff into memory. Remember, this site was designed, we designed this schema for 250 million users. You are not going to be able to keep all of those in memory at any point in time. But it is designed for a lazy, for a load on first hit, and then it can basically stay in memory until evicted by pressure. So for smaller sites, you absolutely can just keep all this stuff memory resident, playing with the consistency boundaries a little bit. For truly large scale stuff, you just can't buy enough memory, but at the same time, not all of your users are online at any given point in time. So it's just that dynamic balance. If you have a captive audience, 50, 100,000 users, pull all that stuff into memory and leave it there. That's fine. But the thing is, the architecture and the topology didn't change. The only thing that changes was your loading policy and your eviction policy. And if you design it that way from the beginning, it's sort of like, oh, we just became wildly successful and a million new users showed up. Okay, I need to change two functions and redeploy. As opposed to, folks, we have to re-architect everything. All right, I spent the first 40 minutes talking about partitioning, which is just about the amount of time I wanted to spend because it's the most important thing. I talked about the hardest partitioning case when we start looking at, when you go to simpler stores, that have native partitioning like tables and cache, you just need to provide the right keys and the rest just happens. All right, optimizing communication. I have beaten asynchronous to death and I will continue to do so. You must leverage asynchronous communication between every time you cross a network boundary. You cannot block on, you cannot synchronously block on IO bound operations. You will bring your entire site down. And we've seen it happen time and time and time again. Before 4.0, I would have felt sympathy. I would have felt bad. I would have had compassion for people writing synchronous code because I was one of them, because it was so hard to do it any other way. That day is over. Whether you write in Node, whether you write in C# and 4.5, it is now straightforward to write performant asynchronous code that is maintainable, is manageable, is debuggable. It's a little harder, but the gains you get in performance, there is no excuse for a cloud-scale application doing synchronous operations. And if you let one sneak through, it will be the thing that brings your system down under load. Who's using WebCF? I would like you all to stop doing that. Four internet-facing REST services. WebCF is a phenomenal technology for making strange things talk to strange things through a unified interface. However, if all you want are REST-based services, you are paying the complexity, scale, throughput, and latency cost of all of that code. You will go through those code paths whether or not you are getting anything out of them. ASP.NET Web API is just as fast, if not faster, far more efficient, far more composable, and about 6 million times easier to debug. Do not use, for .NET projects, anything other than Web API for REST services. You will thank me. Its learning curve is very gentle, all the code is out there to see, and it is crazy fast. I rarely get very enthusiastic about technology. We got this one right. We really got this one right. And I've spent enough time trying to debug WebCF that for simple REST-to-REST services, there's no need. All right, serializers. Let's talk about serializers. Serialization is almost always the most performance-affecting component in any distributed system. The cost to go from an object graph to a byte array and back again is hideous. This is where the .NET team starts to hate me. Do not use any of the standard built-in .NET serializers. They are terrible from a performance perspective. They are absolutely miserable. MVC, the thing we ship, does not use the data contract JSON serializer. It uses the Newtonsoft open source JSON serializer because it's three times faster. You, in a distributed system formed of little boxes stitched together with networking, you cannot pay the cost of standard core .NET serializers. They're too slow, they're too bloated. There are many excellent options out there, all available via NuGet packages with friendly licenses. You use Newtonsoft.json as a standard one in MVC. The service stack.txt is three times faster than that again. As long as you're hiding your serialization behind an abstraction facade, these are configuration pluggable experiences that do not ripple through your code base. But absolutely do not discount the impact of serialization efficiency. It will destroy you. Here's the other thing. Most serializers are asymmetric. Does anyone know what I mean by that? Everyone's looking at me blankly going, you're using words in strange ways. So most of the serializers are across the board for everyone are designed to serve content. They're designed that I want to be efficient on the server and push the load to the client. If I have one server and 10,000 clients, that's good math. In a world of devices, this equation flips when I have a large number of devices pushing data up to services. So all of a sudden, if one quarter of the work happens on the device and three quarters of the work happens on the server, I lose density, I increase my cost of goods. So another thing to watch out for, especially in telemetry-centric scenarios, is what's the symmetry? How much does it cost to serialize versus how much does it cost to deserialize? Some common components that you may have worked with tend to be 2 to 3 times slower to deserialize than they do to serialize. Something to watch out for. Okay. Yes, I've said it before, I will say it again. You must use Azure Storage Library 2.0. It is incredibly more efficient than 1.0, as well as having a stack of features. Just that simple switch. If you've got a lot of storage code, this can ripple because the APIs are slightly different, but the payoff in throughput and debuggability is enormous. Full stop, this is one of the few. There is no engineering trade-off. This is the right thing to do. There may be a hump if you have legacy code. This is the right thing to do. Chunky, not chatty. We've touched on this a few times, and we'll come back to it. How much work can I pack into a given operation, the use of a resource? If I send 25 bytes over the network from service to service, how much network resource did I actually use? It wasn't 25 bytes. Yeah. The MTU. Yeah. 1430 some odd. I'm not actually limited on bandwidth. I'm actually limited on the number of frames per second that I can push through the system. This is just one example of if I'm efficiently using network frames, I'm getting more work out of the resource I'm paying for anyway. If I get 1,000 operations a second and I can put 5 units of work into each, I'm getting a lot more out of them. Do not have truly chatty communication. This is where most ISV apps that are lifted and shifted into Azure fall down, because they traditionally have multi-database aware ORMs that go to the lowest common denominator and don't use any database effectively. And they're incredibly chatty. I've seen things where to open a document took 6,000 database calls. I'm like, I don't even know how you made that scale with giant hardware, let alone bringing it to the cloud. Most of the time, for an application that's being ported, this is one of the areas it's going to have serious performance issues. So look at opportunities to batch. Look at stored procedures. Look at putting multiple operations. Look at buffering. Look at bulk insert. Look at anything where you can pack more work into a single operation. Every network traversal, from I'm a pointer to a structure, to serialization, to encoding, to framing across the network, you're moving a lot of electrons. It's very expensive. Do less where you can. Do more work with less activity. You know the lazy man load where you pick up all your bags of groceries at once and walk to the front door? I see a few nods. I know people who do that. Maybe awkward when you're at your house. It's the right thing to do in cloud. We've gotten away with this. We have an entire 2 generations of programmers that have never had to deal with this because it was lost in the background noise of capitalized assets. If I bought my web servers 3 times bigger than they needed to be because of growth concerns, it didn't show up. It was a rounding error. All of a sudden, when I'm trying to optimize and build the smaller pieces, this stuff jumps up out of the weeds and goes, surprise, you've been writing lazy code for a long time.
But how many people have written applications on this scale 5 years ago?
Quite a many, actually. A lot of folks were writing applications of this scale 5 years ago, but not in the traditional enterprise community. This is what drove the creation of REST, lighter weight HTTP. This is what pushed down SOAP and WS Star. This is what drove the creation of NoSQL databases. So not everybody is working at hundreds of millions of users, but you start to see this stuff at 50 and 100,000 if you're not masking it with hardware. So a lot of what we see coming from the open source community and alternate ways of storing data and moving data and encoding data is driven by these things. Not because we couldn't buy hardware, it's mostly actually driven by dynamic load. As soon as you expose services to the public internet, you don't know the size of your user community. If you're doing corporate services to a captive community, if you have 100,000 employees one day, and you might, if you have 105 the next day, you just did a massive hiring binge. That's pretty easy to capitalize for. I can think of that in 3-year asset depreciation. If I suddenly have a dynamic user community, where I can have 1,000 users today and 1 million users tomorrow because I went viral, you can't buy for that. And then this stuff really starts to kick in. Okay, shifting. In a few minutes we have left for this one, let's talk about shifting. This is the one where I see applications where I have one way to serve data, and it's my relational database, and that's what I want to use because I only want one. I'm like, okay, that's a nice philosophy. Too bad the physics are laughing at you. If there are options where I'm not using all of the functionality of a particular service and I can shift to a more lightweight service. We've talked about caching. Caching is the canonical example of shifting to something that's cheaper. So we think about, it's not practical to go to a durable store for data every time, for data that doesn't change much. Why would I do that? I'm doing more work than is necessary. So, and not all data needs to be immediately and globally consistent. If it's reference data, catalog data that changes every now and then, it's okay if it takes if it's a few seconds or even a few minutes out of date. It depends on the business problem. And this is the one I always chuckle about when people get this idea that ACID is more than it is. An ACID transaction in a database just says that the operations are sequenced. And when a change happens, anything that's sequenced behind it will see the change. But it's not temporally consistent. If I have three people coming in at once, all the database's kind of ACID guarantee says is that if you got in before the transaction, you saw the old value. If you got in after the change transaction, you saw the new value. It didn't say that if two people asked the same question at the same time from two different machines that they got the same answer. So that's one I kind of tease apart. I'm sure you guys are well aware of it. But it's the ACID's not magic. You still have these sequencing problems. So you're already dealing with a temporal consistency issue in a distributed system. Now the only question becomes, how big is that band? How big can we make that consistency band in terms of time and bound and still fulfill business value? And the number's usually a lot larger than people think. All right. So distributed caching, ba-da-da. We've already gone through this in a lot of detail. I'm not going to kind of belabor the point, other than to talk about high availability. Just to come back to this, because this one's important in terms of scalability. When I'm working with a cache, which is a ring of servers that are aware of each other using the Azure topology, I can add new instances and the data will automatically rebalance and automatically repartition. If I remove, I kill data. The ring does not shrink at this moment. So one thing to watch out for in a large-scale system, if you're removing cache nodes, you're going to flush data, even in a high-availability network. In terms of node failure, if I have a failure event, one of two things happens. If I turned on high-availability, I'm getting double writes, so I can read from the secondary. I pay a latency cost on this because I have to put data in two different places, and it's a consistent write. I have to get acknowledgments from the primary and the secondary before I respond. So if you are absolutely must protect your backing store with a cache and you never want to lose data to the life of a service, this is a good option. Just be aware of the cost that you're paying. Okay, talked a little bit about cache. All right, got a few minutes left, so we'll just do a quick recap and see if we've stirred any indignation or questions at the very least. So. Scalability, I must partition. This is the most important thing. I must figure out how to divide my systems, my state, my logic, and then stitch them back together. I didn't go a whole lot into affinity, but affinity is important. Where did I put it? Do I have data that needs to, as related, clustered together? Talk a little bit about optimization. This is the traditional world of pull out the optimizer, pull out the profiler, and see what happens. It's still critically important, because what moving to a bunch of smaller boxes does to us is it highlights the areas where we've been gloriously inefficient. It highlights the chatty connections. It highlights the bad serialization. It highlights the excessive code paths. All of a sudden, the spotlight comes out, and you're like, ooh, maybe we should do something about that. The question is, how do you find these things? How do you find these inefficiencies when I'm running in a distributed system? We'll talk about that in the manageability discussion a little later. So, key thing, these choices, the ability to make these decisions happens at design time when we think about our architecture and we think about our implementation. In the old world, developers largely didn't have to think about scalability of a three-tier app. It was the DBA's problem. The app is slow, it's because the database is slow. Hey, DBA, come behind the scenes, externalize the problem and fix it for me magically. This has unfortunately bred a lot of developers who have not had to think about these things. And that was the right business decision. As we move to elastic scale, as we move to cloud scale, we have to build those muscles back up again. And finally, shifting is embrace polyglot, embrace different ways of getting the job done, embrace services that can do the work for you rather than centralizing in one place. If you're not paying the manageability cost of these services, it's okay to have several of them composed together. We've only really been talking about baseline services, compute, network, storage, and a little bit of SQL. When I move into a world as higher order services light up on the platform, if I want to say, send email, I would never, ever, ever write an email service myself. That's a verticalized piece of expertise that's highly orthogonal to my application. I'm going to rent one. I'm going to go to SendGrid, fantastic partner on Azure, and I'm going to say, if I have email to send, you're responsible for sending it. All of a sudden, there's a huge part of my scalability, my availability, that's just, it's someone else's problem. Now, I take on another service, I may take on another SLA, which we'll talk about in availability, but these are some of the choices. Shift work out of core systems, out of expensive systems where I can, or just peel it off to a completely different system altogether. Partition, optimize, and shift, and we can build some very large scale things on the platform and the tools we have today. Not futureware, but today. All right.
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/series/failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.